Welcome to the Explore Words, Discover Worlds podcast from Bradford Literature Festival. In this episode, Professor Paul Rogers leads a panel of expert commentators in our annual current affairs event, offering a 360-degree view of urgent issues. From ongoing conflict and humanitarian catastrophe in Gaza, to escalating tensions in the Red Sea and South China Sea, and the global impact of Trump's return to office. Recorded live at the 2025 festival, our panel brings clarity, insight, and sharp analysis to the headlines and what lies beneath them.
So we will get started. I'm Paul Rogers. I'm the sort of the loose chair for this session. We've got three really good panelists. It's a very broad topic, the world today. You can't get much worse or much better than that, depending on how you look at it. But I'm delighted to welcome Saeed, Becky, and Adila for this really almost closing session, not quite, and we'll be covering a broad area. I think many of you all know Saeed, who's been a regular at the festival for some time, and making some really good contributions. Becky, I'm not sure you will know. Becky's one of the more recent members of staff in peace studies, a specialist, one essentially in emergency planning and resilience with a particular interest on the nuclear side. And that, I'm afraid, is coming back to the fore in a very unexpected and very unpleasant way. So I'm really pleased she's able to join us. And then Adila, who I think many of you know as well. I don't know if we could use the term a groupie for the festival, but certainly you've been very heavily involved. And in fact, you've just done a session earlier this afternoon, which was great. And what I'm going to suggest, we've actually got an hour and a quarter, which is good. And I know there are a lot of people here. In fact, I think we've virtually got a full house, which is really very nice. So what I'm going to do is Saeed will go first, then Becky, then Adila. Just ask them to speak for a maximum of 15 minutes. So we have best part of half an hour for questions and discussion at the end. If I could ask you to keep the questions pretty brief, the answers will probably be pretty brief, and not necessarily every panelist will answer every question. You know, one goes for your specialities, so you don't feel you have to do that. So, Saeed, you're willing to go first, and I think really interesting, because you're going to give us an update on the state of the United States, particularly on the political side, which I think is going to be... Anyway, over to you.
To me, I think it is that fluidity of what's happening in America that probably is something that has more than just a ripple effect. In some cases, it has a tsunami effect over the ocean, and certainly more broadly. And I was thinking, with a little bit of a literature background, how would Oscar Wilde have put it when it comes to the American elections? To elect Trump once would be seen as a misfortune. To elect him twice would be seen as reckless. And I suppose that's a good point of departure for us to then look at what the Trump era portends moving forward well past 2025. To me, I wonder, and I'd like your assessment of this as well, if you feel that Trump is an anomaly or if he is the apotheosis of Pax Americana. Because while a lot of people will say that Trump's tactics, his demeanor, his personality seem to be outside the pale of his predecessors, others might actually contend that he, in fact, is the embodiment of what America is perceived and received around the world, a sense of brashness, a sense of perhaps imperialism, perhaps a sense of bullying. And perhaps if there is a sin that Trump is committing is that he's saying the quiet part out loud, and he is exhibiting perhaps a rare level of rhetorical candor and honesty, something which perhaps in the United States is not readily apparent because of either the blind spots that are there or that we're just simply too close to the action happening. But nonetheless, the one thing that I do have to perhaps even begrudgingly concede and acknowledge about Trump is that he has been true to his word. And while he himself has denied reading or having been read to Project 2025, the agenda has been quite clear and quite apparent from the very beginning. And Project 2025, of course, was something that was penned by one of the myriad right-wing think tanks in Washington, this one being the Heritage Foundation. And like in other times in history, sometimes a manifesto is written by someone sitting in prison, squandering and wondering if he's going to get out, and then he does, and then he starts this thing called World War II. But in the case of Trump, it seems as though he has been willing to appropriate somebody else's words and somebody else's agenda. It seems as though it's aligned himself rather cynically with these other projects because, quite frankly, maybe he doesn't necessarily have an ideological compass of his own as far as how to strategize what this is. It may be a little bit more, shall we say, parochial when it comes to the bottom line of how it then affects him. It affects the bottom line for his family. It affects his legacy and certainly his bank account. But Trump has captured a moment in American history that is unprecedented. And as sometimes they say, it's not what you have, it's where you are and when you are at that particular moment. And America before Trump was already going through this transition. And it was a series of moral panics. And it seems inexplicable as to why these moral panics were happening. I mean, anybody who is, of course, a student or a scholar of history can go ahead and pinpoint with a certain level of causation why World War I happened. And it wasn't just because an archduke was assassinated in Sarajevo in June of 1914. That's a simplistic thing. If you read people like Philip Blum, they'll say that Europe was jonesing for a war, that these were the vertigo years, and that this was finally just that the straw that broke the camel's back, so to speak. World War II was inevitable given the interwar period and all of the tensions that were just building up and building up and building up. So again, it was in plain sight. America seems to be a little bit more strange because there was no war. There was no complete economic collapse. There was 2008, which of course was a global recession, and it was felt by many, and it was felt at a different level of severity by many. But it's really difficult to go ahead, and I know we shouldn't go ahead and rank economic recessions. I think that's the luxury of those who survived them. But the recession of 2008 paled in comparison to the, for example, the recession of the early 1980s. But perhaps, and scholars far more intelligent than I will argue that maybe it is social media, that as it amplifies everything, it also amplified the internalization of this particular recession. I mean, my students, when I tell them what really was the most significant incident or event that happened in your life prior to COVID and the lockdown, without doubt, they say that it's the 2008 recession. And I said, well, you were probably 1, 2, 3, 4 years old when that happened. They said, yeah, but we felt it in the house. I said, okay, so now we're talking about atmosphere and we're talking about moods that were occurring. But if you take a look from 2008 onwards, and you have the election of Obama, it's followed in very succession with a series of moral panics that are happening, where people want to push back on the kind of enfranchisement that voter rights laws are having. They want to push back on what is seen as a fairly narrow definition of marriage. They want to push back on immigration. They want to push back even on labor and trade union rights and space. They want to push back on, in many cases, phantom religious threats like Sharia law and other such quasi-nefarious onslaughts to American culture. What they all have in common is this sum total of moral panics is America going through a transition, a wormhole, if you will, toward a new America. And that new America, according to demographers now, is somewhere in the next 15 to 20 years when America is going to be reaching what's called a demographic singularity. At that point, the current majority of America, ethnically, racially, culturally, is going to transition to something else. Right now, American identity is seen as being white, Anglo-Saxon, Protestant, but that is going to become less white and more brown, less Anglo-Saxon and more Latin American, less Protestant and more Catholic. And what we find then is that statistics actually do affirm this. The U.S. Census has shown that the population of non-Hispanic whites is actually declining. The population of Protestants has now become a non-majority in favor of Catholics and nuns, not Catholic nuns, but N-O-N-E-S, non-affiliated peoples. And for some, this is seen as an existential threat, not just to identity, but to a cultural landscape to which they have been accustomed and to which they feel as though they own. Now, I can assure you that on whatever day it is, it's kind of like, you know, the 1 millionth person to come to a McDonald's, the person who then tips the scale to which the point that America is no longer majority white Anglo-Saxon Protestant and becomes majority minority, I would actually argue to you that many of the minority communities will uphold the quintessential American white identity because it's the only one that they know. It's a North Star because no one wants to then fear what would be, for example, a dominant Black American identity or a dominant Hispanic American identity. First of all, it's just going to be a plurality of people anyways. But it's interesting to see how these moral panics are playing out. And they're playing out now, of course, in the policies that have been codified thanks to Project 2025. And so when you turn on the television and you see the latest cases of the ICE raids and the abdication of civil rights and civil liberties in the United States, it is all coming from that particular conceit. But to broaden the lens, I also am asking the question that if America is going through this transition, what say us about the West as a project? And I know that in 1956, Prime Minister Anthony Eden really answered that question when it came to whether the sun was setting on the British Empire. The Suez Crisis pretty much took care of that. But we're finding that the West is under a transition right now that if you take a look at the defining features of Western nations or the Western project, it would include a liberal democracy. It would include a fairly open and deregulated market economy. It would include adherence to, a commitment to, rule of law and the international system and order. Constitutionalism, I suppose, would be in that. An open public sphere that also enshrines civil rights and civil liberties and secularism. And now I look at the United States and I look at Britain and I look at France and I look at Germany and I look at Italy and I wonder what's happening to democracy because it seems as though it's becoming more illiberal. And what we have found, particularly and interestingly enough with Gaza, is a question about commitment to international institutions which were created and preserved until now by Western nations, the International Criminal Courts, the International Courts of Justice. All of these things were Western constructs, particularly after World War II, to not only at least advocate for the stated values to define the West, but also to be used as a cudgel against the rest of the world that was not complying with that. But now to go ahead and preempt the decisions of the ICC and the ICJ and saying, oh, well, there's something flawed just because somebody is using it against a Western country, makes one think then that why these anomalies are happening, why the hypocrisies are happening, and what then distinguishes the West from the rest. So we're going through, I think, that transition in a very pronounced and a profound way for us to then consider. Which means then for me, I'm all about Arthurian romance because I was a medieval literature major in college. And I wonder then that if Pax Americana is yielding, there's two things that are going to happen. One is we have to worry about the death throes, how America is going to deal with this when its power is declining. To borrow from Dylan Thomas, I'm not sure it's going to go quiet into that gentle night. And the other thing, to borrow from other lit, I mean, this is a festival for literature after all. I have to wonder that the sword is going to go back in the stone. Who else is going to be willing and qualified to pull Excalibur out? Because as we move into a more multipolar world, there are those that are going to be pretenders to that. And I'm not sure at this stage, and it may just simply be premature, we could probably have more clarity next year when Paul chairs this panel, to see where we are going. My thoughts are that American culture, like English culture, will still be dominant in the world. But that's not going to be enough when it comes to the other issues, economic, political, and military. Those are issues that we need to go ahead and examine as we move forward.
Great.
Absolutely brilliant.
Yeah.
Thank you so much. That was amazing.
Yeah, excellent. That's great. Becky, would you like to carry on?
Yeah, so, oh my goodness, I never thought I'd be here talking to you. It's such a pleasure to be here. So I'm Dr. Becky Alexis Martin. And I'm a lecturer in peace, science and technology. I think I'm actually the only one in the world. So hello, ta-da, I'm here. And I want to talk to you today about the big picture in the context of emergency and humanitarian aid. Now, this is something I've been thinking about for 20 years because I started off my career working in emergency planning and management. And my last big job was on the 2012 Olympics resilience. And I think that we're kind of facing these triple pressure scenarios, basically. So we're witnessing this kind of huge global change to emergency planning and humanitarian aid. So emergency planning is... Oh, hello. Can we still hear me? Oh, amazing. So emergency planning is that kind of planning and preparing for the worst. It can be preparing for anything from flooding, volcanic eruptions, to terrorism, to the consequences of warfare, which we usually call civil defense. Our systems are really changing. And I want to talk just about three kind of ways that they're changing and a little bit about how technology is kind of revolutionizing our humanitarian aid space. And then I want to tell you a little bit about Iran, because I think we can't think about tech for peace without thinking about tech for war. So we've got these humanitarian emergencies that are arising, and they're driven by conflict, by siege, and by famine, and by this kind of health system collapse, essentially. As we've already heard, there's this huge issue with the neoliberalization of kind of health of the economy, and it's causing problems. And it's leading to things like aid budget contractions. We know that US aid is kind of a beautiful memory for those of us who are in the humanitarian aid space. And, you know, particularly from the US, so this is really threatening our, global health and safety nets. And finally, we've got this issue with resilience building. Globally, I don't think we're on the verge of apocalypse. I hope not. But I think that we are not resilient. I think that there's this huge urgency to prepare, and we are hideously underfunded, right? And funding is unevenly scaled. It's not reaching the places where it is needed right now. So we live in an age where kind of the word emergency is no longer exceptional. It's no longer special. We live in an age of disaster, I would say. And it is constant, you know, whether we're thinking about pandemics, whether we're thinking about climate change, whether we're thinking about conflict zones to collapsing healthcare systems, our world is shifting under our feet. And emergency planning is no longer a side function. It needs to become kind of a pinnacle, the foundation of global resilience if we are to continue with society as it is now. So I want to talk a bit first about why emergency planning needs to evolve, why global issues are kind of reshaping risk, and what we as personal, you know, individual people, as governments, you know, as citizens, right, need to do to prepare for this more unpredictable future. So, you know, just in the past year, we've seen this huge change in the global landscape of risk. And this growing famine in Gaza, that's triggered not by, obviously, natural scarcity, by blockades the refusal to include humanitarian aid as part of a conflict. We've seen the collapse of Sudan's healthcare system and war zones turning hospitals into targets, which is just reprehensible. And obviously, it violates the Geneva Convention, just to remind you all. And we've got these more frequent climate-related disasters. We've got record floods in Brazil. We've got wildfires in Canada. And we've got this deadly cyclone season right now in Southeast Asia. And critically, there's this global retreat from international cooperation, which has resulted in these massive cuts of aid by major donors. We have become individualistic. And these are not isolated crises. These are systemic. And they're symptoms of a world where, you know, political instability, climate change, pandemics and inequality are interlinked and accelerating. In my discipline, we call this systems thinking, systems science, because I am, while in peace studies, still a bit of a scientist at heart. And so it's emergency planning is no longer just about responding to disasters, making sure the right humanitarian aid goes to the right place. It's about anticipating them, about preparing for cascading failures, cascading hazards globally, and protecting our most vulnerable before it is too late. So why is it that we're falling short despite the supposed massive humanitarian efforts? So, you know, you turn on the TV, you hear about Gaza, you hear about Ukraine, you hear that there's this attempt to kind of try and change the dynamic, to get in there, to resolve the emergency, to, you know, to respond, to recover. So why are we having these issues? Well, essentially, there's several different reasons. There's issues around short-term thinking. A lot of the time, our plans focus around immediate disaster response, ignoring long-term risks like displacement, health system erosion, and infrastructure decay when we think about these kind of global emergencies. There's this lack of funding. So emergency preparedness receives just 1% of the total humanitarian financing, which I think is a huge issue. So it's like insuring your house for a flood after the waters rise. And there's poor coordination as well. There's silos between agencies, governments, and sectors. It creates overlaps and gaps. Data doesn't flow. Decisions are delayed and lives are lost. And I think almost most importantly, there's exclusion issues. So communities, particularly disabled people, queer people, women, indigenous groups, are rarely included in planning as a specific group when we're thinking about these kind of global catastrophes, despite always being the most affected. If you look at the mortality statistics for almost any disaster, you will find that often, you know, women are more affected, not just through health, but also kind of culturally and socially. So what do we need to do to change this thing? You know, how do we make things more effective? So we need to begin to think about kind of what we're going to do, right? We need to begin to use real-time data. We need to think about forward-looking risk models globally. And we need to make the most of things like AI and satellite monitoring to kind of predict crop failures, track disease spread, and model and understand, you know, the impacts of warfare as it progresses and as it develops and, you know, before the disaster hits a lot of the time. And we need to think that communities are not just beneficiaries, they're frontline responders, right? So we need to start thinking globally, but investing locally. So investing in local emergency response, you know, from first aid teams to kind of grassroots supply chains, it's really important. And we need to begin to link health, food, shelter, climate, and conflict systems. So a flood is never just a flood, for example. It can lead to cholera, displacement, violence, and school closures, just to name a few issues. And we also need to start thinking about how we get trained personnel in place before the crisis. This is an international issue. You know, how do we make sure that we have pre-positioned stock, for example? For an example, the World Food Programme, so the UN's programme to distribute food, has pre-positioned stock, so food ready in places that might be vulnerable, and it's saved thousands of lives during cyclone season. And we need to be transparent and community-driven, so gender, disability, and youth perspectives need to be central. They need to not just be tacked on. So emergency planning, it's not just a kind of national or local issue, it is global. Emergencies cross borders, nuclear accidents cross borders. You know, we just need to look at Chernobyl, COVID, viruses cross borders. So do refugee flows, and so does misinformation. And so we need to kind of change our attitude. Like, international solidarity is at risk, from what I can see. And the recent pullback of US foreign aid has threatened health systems across 40 countries, you know, this resilience. And the UN has already warned that these cuts could result in millions of preventable deaths. So we need to change this tide. So what do we do? We need to push for multi-year humanitarian financing, first of all. We need to try and secure the future in light of the US's kind of more neoliberal attitudes and get that funding from other places. We need to think about kind of strengthening early warning systems, like the famine early warning system, for example. And we need to begin to rebuild trust in multilateral action. We've become isolated. Quite a lot of nation states now, they're run by these populist leaders, right, who are quite selfish and quite individual nation state focused. We need to regain our trust. We need to work with, you know, organizations like the UN, like the IFCR, cross-sector alliances, to kind of start, you know, changing our world and start making ourselves less vulnerable. Because we're only as resilient as the most vulnerable among us, whether we're thinking about kind of local, national, or international humanitarian aid. So emergency planning, humanitarian aid, it's not just a technical exercise. It's a moral imperative. It's the difference between chaos and coordination, between suffering and safety, between life and death. And we need to move beyond kind of reacting to disaster and start anticipating it, particularly in light of climate change. And we need to fund, train, equip, and include before the next crisis strikes. Because the emergencies of tomorrow are already knocking on our door. And the question is, you know, are we ready to answer? I think one of the things that's really important as kind of humanitarian disasters begin to unfold is that we are developing new technologies. We're looking at kind of ways forward that will allow us to, you know, to develop, to have new opportunities. So obviously crises, they demand urgent, effective and efficient responses. And this is kind of where technology is transforming where we respond and what's possible. So let's begin with drones. So drones have a bad rep, right? They're often seen as kind of military toys, as tech, you know, military tools, tech toys. But they're now delivering medical supplies to, you know, remote villages in Rwanda. They're surveying disaster zones and they're mapping refugee camps in Gaza to help relief organizations to better coordinate resources. They're quite literally lifting aid off the ground, which I think is amazing, and putting it exactly where it's needed. And then there's blockchain technology. So in Jordan, the World Food Programme is currently using blockchain to help Syrian refugees buy food using secure digital identities. So basically, they don't have to have a bank account, they don't have to have physical money, and it helps kind of reduce corruption, it helps improve transparency, and it ensures that the money actually reaches the people who should have it, rather than it being lost in kind of chains of corruptions that so often, you know, occur in these kind of fragile places and vulnerable places. And I think while the potential is enormous, I mean, this is just two examples. I've got 15 minutes and I don't want to talk you to death, but I think the hard question, of course, is who controls these technologies and how do we make sure that we're protected from things like surveillance, data misuse, or exclusion due to digital divide? So technology must always serve humanity. That is my belief, and not the other way around. And it has, as I've, you know, shared through these two examples, tremendous potential in kind of helping us in this new age of crisis and emergency management. And so while we celebrate innovation and technology, it's essential that we pair it with ethics, with equity, and with empathy. I think the best humanitarian technology isn't just smart, right? It's fair, it's inclusive, and it's grounded in the needs of the people that it's supposed to help. And so I think the future of emergency planning, the future of humanitarian aid, it won't just be powered by improved economic circumstances, although that is an absolutely essential kind of criterion, something we really need. It won't just be powered by, you know, goodwill. It'll be powered by gigabytes, by algorithms, by global collaboration. And if we get it right, we won't be able to just respond better to disasters. We'll be able to prevent them, rebuild stronger, and leave no one behind. Thank you.
Great. Thanks so much. Thanks very much, Becky. Yes, you can hear me at the back. Thanks very much, Becky. So hand over now to Adila for the final contribution.
Thank you. It's great to see another full house in this lovely room and to both other speakers. It's funny, actually, Becky, because when I first started my journalism career, I was a resilience reporter. So it's kind of sad in a way to hear that 10 years later, it's still, you know, disaster is everywhere. I'm approaching this slightly differently to both of you. I kind of thought about this on the fly, on the drive here. And I was thinking about the world today. And I guess I want to talk about four hotspots that stand out to me. So the first one is Sudan, which my dad is from, and a country that I visited a lot when I was younger. And that for me is one of the biggest underreported news stories of the year and likely into the next year. I think I was thinking about the refugee crisis that conflict has actually caused, and how there's been so much, obviously, here in the UK and elsewhere, focus on refugee crisis from North Africa across to Europe. But actually, the Sudanese conflict has created a massive migration out of Sudan to Eritrea, Ethiopia, Egypt, Saudi Arabia. And that's like a big issue for the Middle East that I think we're not reporting enough on in the West, the impacts of that. Obviously, the famine, which Becky touched on as well, is just devastating. We've had personal reports of parents shredding up newspaper to feed to children. And, you know, it's really wiped out a generation. The middle classes, if they've got money, have completely fled and likely not to return again. People like my father's generation will probably they dreamt of retiring, going back from the West to Sudan to help it to prosper, and that's now changed, and they're having to readjust their plans. So I think that's an interesting underreported hotspot which has shaped the world today. The next one, I was also listening to both of you and thinking, like, is there any bright spots? Is there anything positive that we can tell people about? And I'm not sure this one exactly fits, but I thought Syria has been really fascinating in the last year, the removal of Bashar al-Assad, and I think we kind of blinked and missed it because there's been so many other major news stories going on that have got our attention, Trump and Gaza and everything else. But that's really, I mean, I felt that was more people-led than a lot of other changes of power. And I think that'll be an interesting country to watch how that develops, the support it gets internationally, what it says about its former allies, for example, Russia, China, to see how that country will pick itself back up and the impact that will have in the Middle East and in Europe and elsewhere where many Syrian refugees have made a home. And then the other thing I thought about was, as Saeed was saying, in the United States, obviously I work at the Washington Post and I cover US politics and breaking news. And I was thinking, is this the beginning of the end? And it's something that we can talk about more, but the soft power of the US, the political power of the US, the fact that even Europe is struggling to make excuses to combine with the US still, what does this mean for places like China? Is this really the beginning of the weakening of United States in the United Nations, these global infrastructure? I think the backing that we've all just taken for granted and this kind of post-war order could now be fully rearranged with the rise of, well, the continuation of Trump. And then I was thinking also finally about people power and general public political apathy, it feels like, that people are so fed up with politics and they're so fed up with not having a home that neatly fits with their views, both in the UK and elsewhere. And I was wondering maybe if prediction perhaps more for the world going ahead, if we're going to see the rise of more kind of single issue political parties or people taking power into their own hands. So for instance, we're reading about, you know, Zara Sultana here in the UK, potentially Jeremy Corbyn, you know, forming these new parties. We've got Elon Musk tweeting that he wants to start this new American party. So I don't know, I just wondered if going forwards, the world in 2026 might look very different. And if there is, you know, people capitalizing on how to take political grievances and apathy and you know, are we going to get further siloed into our issues to the benefit of people who are good at getting power? So yeah, sorry, that was brief. But I was just thinking, yeah, how the world may look going forwards and how perhaps more underreported elements of the world as it is this year.
Great, thanks so much. I'll just briefly add one slightly different way of looking at it. If you take a single country, the UK, what are the kinds of things that people think could happen that are good, new directions? And one can actually, this is the possibilities, but it's worth remembering this. I mean, the first is that obviously we are becoming a steadily less equal society by the year. It is extraordinary that we are a wealthy country where we even have the concept of a food bank. It shouldn't exist in the first place. We never think that way because it's crept up on us. So essentially, we need wealth taxes and other means, but we need to change around that part of the system. I think we can see also that there is no good reason, when you look at it dispassionately, to increase defense spending. In fact, there's a much better reason to decrease it. Personally, my view is that we remain a nuclear power because it's part of a delusion of post-imperial grandeur and serves very little good in terms of security of the country. If anything, it goes the other way. If we actually altered our thinking on that, then we would say, what's the biggest security problem? And the biggest security problem, bar none, is climate breakdown. That's the one that has to be addressed fully. For a start, I mean, any cutback in what we call overseas aid needs to be reversed, and the money taken from that to defense needs to be reversed. But more than that, now, the whole business about overseas aid, I worked in the aid system early in my career, and you can see there are all sorts of problems with it. A lot of aid is basically investing in new markets. A lot of it is loans which have to be repaid. But there can also be very high quality assistance. And there are many ways. Probably the best single way to improve the global situation is to aid countries in the global south that are more impoverished than most to make the transition to green economies quickly and easily. the biggest single thing you could do. It would not cost a huge amount of money. And it's just looking at it in a different way and always keeping it at the back of your mind that there are different ways of doing things. It's worth remembering that in a country like Britain, we have had major successes in the last 50 or 60 years. In spite of all the problems, the health of the population has the potential to be better. Overall, we have many problems on the what you might call the interpersonal relations, but there's been huge progress. I mean, I can remember well when gay people were threatened with imprisonment, and that was a regular thing. We're beyond that now, and I think we have to recognize there are possibilities of positive change as well. So I just put that in at the starter, just always to bear that in mind. I suppose it's this old idea that a very good definition of prophecy seems to be counterintuitive. And if you define prophecy as suggesting the possible, then it can be a very useful way of having an outlook. Because you're always thinking, well, how could this be done better? And are there ways we can achieve it? So let's just add that as a sort of a feature into the discussion. Otherwise, we're going to get very morose in the next half hour or so. We've got plenty of time. What I suggest is I'll take questions just in twos, and could you keep them brief, please? And then we'll get through as many as we can, because we've got plenty of time this afternoon. We don't want to waste it. There's one question there, and there's one at the back here. So can we start with those two? Do we have the rolling mics? I hope we do.
So thank you for that last point about climate breakdown. I wonder if we could unpack that. Timescale, and how does that play out? I assume... Well, no, I'll keep my question short. I won't try and answer the question. Thank yeah. you.
Okay, climate, right, the climate. And is it possible to take the one over here as well? Is there a second roving? Oh, if there is, yes, there we are.
So the first question goes about what he talked about, the global economy. So in my thinking, I'm just asking, is this the work of neoliberalism? Because according to Naomi Klein, neoliberalism exists on shocks, wars, catastrophes. What we're seeing in Gaza, it is like privatization. We're seeing American companies delivering aid. It's like the world is not shifting anywhere. I just feel like this is the work. This is how neoliberalism works. So I just don't see whether there is a major difference. So you can help me on that and clarify. Thank you. The second is about sub-Saharan Africa. When I talk of neoliberalism, I'm talking of Rebecca, who came here as a student to do peace, conflict, and development at the University of Bradford. But I come from sub-Saharan Africa. That's Uganda. So the whole shift on humanitarianism, and it feels like this multipolar world is different. What we are here is different from sub-Saharan Africa. It's like we're taking East and the West is taking the other way.
Let's take it from that. That's really helpful. I'll take very quickly on the climate thing, then other people might comment. I mean, the curious thing is on the climate, what we need to have is very rapid decarbonisation, societal-wide, economy-wide. The point is, we know it's much more possible now than we thought even 15 years ago. In so many areas, renewable energy sources are below grid parity, well below grid parity, for the use of gas, oil, or coal. And although you have a very powerful lobby trying to prevent an appreciation of that, the reality is that actually doing it is cheaper and possible to do. So particularly in terms of aiding across the global south. So there's a lot of potential there which is unrealizable, but essentially is possible. That's my personal view. Other people want to comment that, and then we'll take the second question. Anybody?
Yeah, actually. So there's several major climate emitters. You've touched upon decarbonisation. There's also issues with construction. So one of the things that most people don't realise is that cement is one of the largest CO2 emitters out there. So if we start reusing the buildings that we've already got in the global north, making the most of what we already have, and if we encourage sustainable building methods in the global south, that would be an amazing approach to cut our carbon emissions. The other issue, of course, it's the big roaring issue in the room, is methane, right? So agriculture, we need to find sustainable ways to feed our population. We need to find ways, you know, we'll support and prevent this kind of massive global inequality. So one of the things that really gets me about climate, the climate crisis, so I studied an environmental management master's, and I am like, I've been angry about this for about 20 years now, and I'm only young. So it's the fact that there's this gaping global inequality and there's this climate colonialism, right? where these less, you know, these majority world, so global south nation states, get our waste dumped on them, get the environmental impacts of manufacturing dumped on them, and then don't get the support afterwards. And I would say that this climate colonialism and the neoliberalism associated with it, to answer your question, Rebecca, which was incredibly eloquent, thank you, are two of the kind of greatest issues of our time. And if we can resolve kind of the way that we essentially, you know, treat the global south a bit like a dustbin still in some ways, we would reduce our carbon emissions. And if we can support and uplift the global south to have sustainable technology, as Paul was saying, we would be in a much stronger place. So we've all seen that nature paper with the hockey stick curve, right? We all know that we are going through a climate crisis. And the challenge now is to stop it and to stop the further impacts while we still have opportunities to do so, right? We're already experiencing severe weather, or weather weirding, as I prefer, because it's a cute term, but severe consequences. We're already experiencing economic, social, environmental, and health impacts too. So some of the things we don't talk about are, for example, the spread of tropical diseases, right? As the climate changes, as the weather gets kind of more, you know, more hospitable to these conditions, we are finding things like malarial mosquitoes in places they never used to live before. We're finding conditions like we're finding tropical conditions in places where we didn't find them before. And so we really need to think not just kind of about climate change as climate change, but as a systems-related global health, environmental, economic, cultural, and social crisis that has the greatest consequences to the global south. So thank you to the gentleman who asked about this and raising such an important question of our time.
Before we go on to the second question, Saad, can I just ask you, we've had this pretty dreadful disaster in Texas in the last 36 hours, and it looks like there may well be 70 or 80 people killed, including many children. Climate scientists have been saying relentlessly for at least two decades that a sure sign of climate breakdown will be more extreme events, and the events will be more extreme. And this, you can't say that this was due to climate breakdown, but essentially the chances are very high that it is. That doesn't seem to register at all with the media in the United States. Is it so solid on the Trump era side that there can be no movement on that, or where do we stand on that?
I think in the United States, climate change has become like gun control. It's become static. I mean, it's a done deal. But I would say that on the case of what's been happening in Texas, and it's horrifying. The causation may not be something that we can necessarily prevent easily or on the cheap. But to take away some of the preventative measures, or at least the detection measures, or the post-factum measures, that seems to be really counterproductive. So the Trump administration has actually reduced the budget of FEMA, the Federal Emergency Management Association. They have even gone ahead and cut the budget of the National Atmospheric and Oceanic Science Administration. So weather reports are now politicized. So the ability for people to then go ahead and use predictive technology, or to rely on these sources to say, you know what, there's a big rainstorm coming in, somehow or the other, that's not even there. These kinds of processes aren't so simple as you just put your hand out and you know, check to see if it's raining or not. We have to wonder why there is the contempt for even then saving the people. We may not be able to have the kind of commitment to change policy on climate action and all, but for God's sakes, I mean, FEMA is an agent for good. It is providing emergency relief. And yet here we find that these agencies have been hobbled as much as it has been on the foreign stage with USAID.
It's worth saying, incidentally, that one action that a government in Britain could do, and in fact, France is already considering it, is to go for really increasing resources for all this kind of work, and make sure you pick some of the best American scholars to come over and help you do it, because they're basically being made redundant. It's a job that, you know, a country like Britain could do, increase its own work, not one David Attenborough research vessel, but half a dozen, and increase the oceanographic work, the atmospheric work, and the rest. It's peanuts compared with putting up defense spending by sort of several billion a year. And it's hugely important. Anyway, Adela, would you like to, do you want to come in on this, or do you want to look at the other question as well?
We've reported so much on like hurricanes and extreme heat in the US. Is there a disconnect between the people and the politicians because they're living through the effects of climate change without anyone actually calling it climate change? And it reminds me, my sister's a doctor in Phoenix in Arizona, and during COVID she treated a Republican politician who had COVID and was tweeting, there's no such thing as COVID. So I don't know, I feel like people are living through the effects of climate change without actually giving it the name. And how long is that sustainable in the United States? I don't know.
Further comments on the second question? Anybody want to come in on that?
No, but I did want to add in the context of UK emergency planning that we are already making some really interesting changes. So we've just launched the National Resilience Academy, and there's this big push for apprenticeships in emergency planning and management, if you're interested. And also, we've released recent reports that suggest that the UK needs to begin civil defence. So we need to become better at preparing for emergencies, and that we are not prepared. So I wanted to say, Paul, you're exactly right. And I totally agree. We need to be pushing for more work like this. So
I think on the issue of sub-Saharan Africa, I mean, we have to be mindful that this is a region that is only slowly emerging from the colonial project. And I wonder about empires. I mean, many of these empires are now gone. And I must say, I mean, I include the United States in this. The infrastructure is terrible. How many of you have visited the United States? How many of you have made an attempt to find public transport? Right, keep looking. But I grew up in England till I was 8. And I left here in 1975. And it struck me that given the British colonial project and empire, what happened to all the money? I mean, my favorite footballer growing up was George Best. And George Best famously said, when somebody asked him, what did you do with all your money? He says, well, I spent it on booze, birds, and fast cars. The rest I squandered. And it makes me wonder then that I look at former empires, which, by the way, haven't been former empires for very long. And it seems like they didn't really invest their money well in mutual funds. But the idea then that to expect places like sub-Saharan Africa, places in what is sometimes known as a developing world, to say, right, well, you'd better go ahead and do this, and you'd better go ahead and do this, and you'd better adhere to, you know, certain kinds of standards of decarbonization and all. The pollution we have today was actually created 150 years ago during the colonial period by the colonizing forces. So I think that there is a severe chasm in the ideology and the ability to talk about the causation of these issues. Then and only then are we really going to be able to find some kind of a solution.
Yeah. I'm struck by a saying that was passed on to me by a Ghanaian friend when I was a student 60 years ago. And he said simply, you know, Paul, very good reason why the sun never set on the British Empire. And I said, what's that? God didn't trust the British in the dark. And in many ways, that sums up a lot of the attitude. And let's go to further questions. Who else would like to ask one?
Thanks. I was wondering whether or not I would suggest that one of the consequences of capitalism is that we have been trained collectively to easily dehumanize others, which then enables us to consume with disregard for the consequences for the environment and for other people. So my question is whether or not there is some way of pushing that back, because we see the consequence of dehumanization through the response to the kind of tragedies we're seeing around the world. And even in what people might call identity politics and the wars, that people become reduced to just one thing and we lose nuance. So my question is, how do we reverse that?
Can we take that one first? Would you want to start, Ed?
Sure. Thank you for the question. You know, you're talking about identity. And yesterday, actually, here in Bradford, there was this wonderful event. It was a taping of the Doha debates that are being put on by Al Jazeera, which I think formerly used to be put on by the BBC, but we can talk about both the financial and the ideological reasons why they're not, but certainly to the benefit of all of us, it's been resurrected. And the topic was national identity and the nation state. And I think when the episode comes out, I mean, I would certainly encourage everyone to look at that. Because in many ways, I think what we're talking about, and certainly moving forward, is the identity crisis that people are having either on a national level or on a global level. I don't think we really think about or understand who we are anymore. And as a result of that, I think that our relationship to the state, our ability to then even articulate what the issues are that face us, that impact us, to then try to get some kind of recourse from that is elusive to many people. But on the issue of the economics, I would suggest that there's a bigger problem as well. 25 years ago, Norina Hertz wrote a book called The Silent Takeover.
Yeah.
Anyone? Okay, Paul read it. Okay, so she sold two books, but at least for this crowd. Back then, 25 years ago, she said that over 50%, that a slight majority of the world's biggest economies were not sovereign states, they were corporations.
Yeah.
25 years on, that number has skyrocketed. I mean, if you think about just the cash reserves of an Apple, I mean, it's not anymore like what we had in the 1980s with hostile takeovers where, you know, Apple might take over or, you know, buy out Microsoft. Apple can go in now and buy out Madagascar or something like that, another sovereign state. So we're living in this 400-year old project where the British East India Company came in, served as a corporation, was just maniacally wealthy, took a lot of money out of India, but when it panicked and it couldn't handle it anymore, it handed it over to the sovereign, it handed it to the crown. Well, now I don't think that the corporations are doing that. In fact, the sovereign has now become subordinate to the corporation, and it is a huge shift that is happening in plain sight. I don't think that we're really aware of it and the implications of that. So something to pay attention to as we move forward.
Further comments on that?
Thinking about empathy, I think, is really important and how we can create a more empathetic world. And I think that we need to kind of rediscover connecting with each other. We need to think about kind of how we can overcome these kind of overarching segregations and differences that we've embedded since the Cold War, I would say, arguably. And I think much of the work that needs to be done is in rehumanizing. And we need to kind of get in there. We need to, as societies, we need to begin to kind of engage with our local communities to undertake acts of everyday kindness. There's some amazing writing, actually. If you don't mind a gentle academic paper, I would love to send you to Dr. Ellie Harrowell, who is an alumni of Bradford Peace Studies, now at Coventry Peace Studies, and her work on kindness, because I think it's an incredibly powerful entity to rediscover that kindness, to rediscover that tolerance for each other that we had in the gentler 1990s in some ways, I think. And we have this kind of aggressive dialogue, don't we, from disenfranchised groups, whether it's in the manosphere, whether it's neo-Nazis, they're out there. And the internet serves as an echo chamber for us all, doesn't it? For better or for worse. So I think we need to begin to hold organizations like Meta accountable for the decisions that they make when they filter and when they accept what is permitted online and what is not, to make that a space of a kind of positivity and for empathy and for reconciliation rather than for hate. I feel as though it's kind of an age where it's allowed to proliferate in an untrammeled way. And to really get empathy back, we need to stop that. Some voices actually do not need to be heard.
Do you want to comment on that?
Yeah, I was just going to say it's a great question, and I agree. Like, there's a lack of nuance. And I think identity politics, I remember covering the George Floyd and the Black Lives Matter and how that was a very local thing in the US and just flooded and became global, and there was, you know, mass protests. So I think identity politics are huge and they're still very important. I think we're increasingly seeing the weaponization of identity, you know, politics of those such as Nigel Farage or the rise of the far right elsewhere in Europe. I think people, politicians are benefiting from siloing people and reducing people to certain smaller boxes, and I think that's dangerous. But I think events like this, when we're all sat in a room, we're all different cultures and faiths and identities. And I think getting to know people, I think mixing, I think education are all ways that we can counter that reduction of our identities. And I think that's really positive. And then just to touch on the Ukraine question, it's such a huge, you know, unknowable how it will end. But I don't know how it will end, but I do feel that it will end soon. We're talking about 2025. I predict we will not still be discussing the war in 2026, because I think there is a real momentum now to end the war. And I think parties, Putin, Trump, Zelensky, everyone's pushing and pulling in different directions, but I do think that it will end soon.
I think that is possible. If I may come in on that as well. I mean, I think one thing about the Ukraine war is that it is a stalemate in every sense, but it's a violent stalemate. And one can say that because if, for example, Ukraine was to make huge headway, as it might, you never know, then Russia could come in with a threat of escalation to weapons of mass destruction. If, on the other hand, Russia was to make major steps forward, NATO's credibility cannot survive disaster in Ukraine. And somewhere or another, more would happen. And so it is stalemated. And stalemated, well, it has two consequences. One, and this was remarked on in the session we had earlier with Jeremy, is that what it does mean is it is a glorious time to be an arms salesperson. It really is. It can hardly be bettered to have a stalemate with all these weapons and all these new weapons being tried out and bought. The other thing is that it can only end in negotiations. If it's stalemated militarily, it has to end in negotiations. And one wants to share a dealer's comments, and it's certainly possible. I mean, it looks like it could happen. Much, I'm afraid, will depend on the attitude of a certain president you got over there, but at least it is possible. But anyway, other comments on Ukraine? Go on.
I guess to answer the question, I have to ask a question that, what does it mean to end? I was in an earlier session with Ian McGregor and with Sinclair McKay, I mean, really brilliant historians on this, looking at World War II and how it's impacting the current global affairs. And historians have now come to the conclusion that World War I didn't end in 1918. Ask anybody in the colonies and asking anybody who was in Europe at the time with all of the different things going on. World War II was simply a continuation of World War I. And the Cold War, arguably, is a continuation of World War II. And so if we're using that as the metric, then there is the possibility that Ukraine will be one of many endless wars. I mean, this seems to be one of the strategies of Netanyahu in Israel, that this is just simply going to be an endless war. There may be what used to be called wars of attrition. In 1967, after the Six-Day War, the war between Egypt and Israel still continued. Yeah. Just ask all of the families who lost people in the Sinai from 67 to 70. So again, I think it's more than just a semantic issue to say what do we mean by end? Because if nothing ever dies on the internet, then why should we expect a conclusion at a time of war as well?
Absolutely. Brilliant comment. And I think that academics like Derek Gregory have argued for this kind of notion of what we call forever war, where we reach this impasse situation. And my concerns are that NATO and the UN are not acting. They are not, responding in a way that is actually creating resolution in this space. And I personally would quite like to see Russia off the Security Council. I think it's very unlikely to happen, but I would like to see it. I think it's time that the world took action against, this particular space of conflict and the perpetrators. And as you said, when I think about how it will end and what concessions will Ukraine have to make, because my concern is that the Ukrainian state and the Ukrainian people will be put in a position where concessions will be necessary, due to Russia's militarization, due to Russia's nuclearization. And in light of their essentially war crimes and their violations of conventions, of the Geneva Convention, for example, by bombing nuclear installations like nuclear energy, nuclear power plants, I again question, Russia's right as kind of a custodian of things like nuclear weapons. They present a very good argument for disarmament in my eyes because of their actions and how they've behaved in an irrational way. And I really hope it ends soon. As a journalist, I think you've probably got some good ideas there, and you probably know more than me in my current space. But I just feel, I feel like these wars persist, and who knows what will come next. And what we need to do is we need to stop profit from warfare. We need to find a way to use these technologies for peace. I already discussed a few ways that technologies for warfare can be used for humanitarian aid. Why are we not focusing on that? Thank you.
Right, we've got time for a couple more questions, certainly. There's one down here. I'll just see anybody else around here. Can we take this gentleman here and then this lady here, I think?
Thank you for the amazing talk. So my question was about the rise of the far right. because I think that is, along with the climate change, is one of the biggest threat that we are facing. And the way the far right is marching, not only in the Western world, but also in the developing South. I mean, you see the case of India, you see the Philippines, you see Turkey. All these are being governed by very far right governments. So what is the reason that the far right is so successful? Is it because people are just getting poorer and it's easier to turn them one against each other? Or there are much deeper reasons for that? And is there, have they reached a peak, especially in America, where we have very nearly have a New York mayor who is possibly not far right, he's probably a Democrat and he's probably getting elected. So have they reached a peak, or they're still about to rise even more?
That's fine. Thanks so much. And this over here, please.
I'd just like to the comments about migration, which seemed to me to be one of the huge issues of our time. I mean, obviously, due to economic inequality, conflict, climate change, feels we could obviously be doing much more for those countries to help stop it.
And
but nevertheless, it feels, in the short term, certainly pretty unstoppable because of those massive issues. And adds to, obviously, the rise of the right in Europe and America. So I'd like your sort of comments about...
And in many ways, those two fit together in terms of the far right. Could we have... let's try and fit in two more questions as well. So can we have quick answers? No, I won't take them now. Quick answers to those two and then do a final round. I think we can get away with that this late in the day.
So I think on the far right question, I think that what we're finding is I'm more interested in who are the enablers. In the case of some of the countries that you mentioned with the rise of the far right, it's really the corporatists, it's the plutocrats who are enabling this and preying on the moral panics and the anxieties of the more marginalized groups. You see this happening particularly in India. It's certainly happening in a strange kind of complicity with the United States about people like Elon Musk and also. Which I think surprisingly is different than it was in Germany in the 1920s. You really did not have a group of corporatists that were backing the Nazi Party. He actually, ironically, went straight to the disenfranchised people. Franco in Spain had the church. Modi has a bunch of industrialists. I think that there has to be seen that who are these other elements that are enabling and working with these governments.
It's worth remembering that it can happen the other way around. Dated early 1970s, the Greek colonels, Franco, and what's his name in Portugal, Salazar, all went within a year. And of course, we do have other ones worldwide, Bolsonaro over to Lula, and not at the same level, but the election in Australia was significant as well.
And they also blocked a right-winger in Canada.
Yes, true. Do you want to come in?
Yeah, I mean, I'll just say briefly, I feel slightly more pessimistic than that. I feel
sorry about that.
Maybe the world has always historically been more center-right than we think it's been, and the left is kind of the abnormal structures. And I also feel that many countries are set up in such a way that the systems benefit the right and people staying in the same rather than the radical changes always at the edges from what I've observed. And then that links to the migration and obviously that feeding in. I think climate migration is really a thing. And I remember reading papers about how the Syrian war potentially started because all of these farmers were out of work because their crops had dried up. And so they started to join local militias or people that would pay them. So I don't know. I think it is all terribly linked. And I do feel pessimistic about that.
One has to face up. I mean, one of the very big effects of climate breakdown will be an increase in migration, which is another good reason to be working very hard to prevent it.
Yeah.
Let's fit in a couple. Do you want a quick comment before?
Yeah, so I've actually done quite a lot of work on migration and conflict and also migration and the climate crisis with a specialism in the Pacific. So one of the things I've noticed that a lot of the time, the recipient nation states, if they are going to receive people from other places, so for example, we can think of Kiribati, Tuvalu, Samoa in the Pacific and Australia, right? They often need the workers. They have special visas for these migrants so that they can come and they can come and do work, despite obviously their own environment and their land being threatened. And it offers an opportunity as well for development in the donor nation state because money gets back in remittances, which means that these places can begin to grow and develop a little better and actually become less reliant on welfare and aid and support. So maybe they're two surprising things about migration. Now, I did a lot of work on the Syrian crisis back in the day, and I spent quite a lot of time in Calais camp, actually, in the absolutely deplorable conditions. I worked with the women to help them kind of learn English and to help them make sure that they knew their rights and that they were protected by French law. And during the Syrian crisis, we were absolutely appalled, weren't we, 2015, kind of watching this disaster unfold. And there was a huge wave of migrants. But what we don't talk about is that the majority of those migrants ended up in places like Lebanon. They ended up in places like Syria. I think it was 2.7 million who ended up in Lebanon, which is an absolutely tiny nation state. And less than a couple of 100,000 reached the UK. And the thing we also don't talk about is they go home. They don't want to stay here. A lot of the time, they have their culture, they have their society, they have family, friends, homes. They might have, you know, excellent, they might have professions, they might be doctors, engineers, nurses, and they just want to go back. So after conflict, often post-conflict, return migration is incredibly common. So I think it's difficult because we live in a society where these misnomers and these misunderstandings about migration are really perpetuated by our media. And we've always had waves of migration in the UK. You know, whether we look at the 1960s, so where I'm from, I'm a proud Leeton girl, and we had the Vauxhall plant, we had the hospitals, we had the hospitals in London, right? We had Pakistani migrants, Afro-Caribbean migrants, we had Eastern European migrants, you know, all in different waves, 50s, 60s, 70s, 80s, 90s. And before, we are a nation of migrants. We've been invaded by the French, by the Vikings, by the Icelandic, you know. I mean, what does it even mean to be English, right? We can look at what constitutes British identity through scholars like Benedict Anderson and thinking about how we create communities ourselves and how we decide what we are now. But arguably, when we look at the UK, we are one of the most wealthy societies in the world, right? And yeah, our Gini coefficient isn't great. We've got some inequality, but essentially we have an excellent welfare system. We have millions of taxpayers, and I think we can afford a few migrants. And also, they bring us economic benefits. They care for our elderly. They care for our sick. So that's my perspective. Thank you.
One point, if I might just add to that.
Yes, so please do. Sorry.
A million go to Lebanon, which is 25% of the population. Yeah. 3 million go to Turkey.
Yeah.
I would actually argue that we are at a moment in human history where migration is actually lower than it ever has been. Mm-hmm. If you look at it as movement of human people, there are simply far too many restrictions on it. What has ironically increased is as migration has decreased, the percentage of refugees of people moving has increased. Yeah. So I think that needs to be understood.
It looks like we've run out of time, unfortunately. I'm really sorry about that. I should have been a bit tougher as a chair, but we've been through a very good discussion with some really good panelists. Thank you very much for coming.
Thank you. Yes.
Thank you for joining us for this episode of the Explore Words, Discover Worlds podcast with Bradford Literature Festival. If you enjoyed this episode and you'd like to help support the podcast, please subscribe, share this episode with others and leave a rating. Mark your calendars for the return of Bradford Literature Festival, Friday the 3rd to Sunday the 12th of July, 2026.